and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Chris Jones. FTX cryptocurrency exchange imploded spectacularly in 2022, and its founder, Sam Bankman-Fried, has been sentenced to 25 years in prison, convicted of fraud. But if you thought his story is an isolated one, you'd be wrong. The culture of Silicon Valley has often been summed up in one simple phrase: fake it until you make it. So perhaps it's no surprise that this trillion-dollar industry is shrouded in criminality. But how did it get here, and will it ever change? Well, I'm delighted to say that I'm now joined by Erin Griffith, who's a New York Times reporter specializing in startups, finance, and tech, and she's written all about this many times. Hi, Erin.
Hi.
Just for avoidance of doubt, most people will know what Silicon Valley is, but just for people who perhaps don't, just could you sum up what it is and what its influence is as well?
Sure. I mean, so technically speaking, Silicon Valley is a region that's about an hour south of San Francisco that includes Palo Alto, Stanford University, and a road called Sand Hill Road, where there's a ton of venture capital firms who invest in startups that are based all around the region that grow up to become big companies like Facebook, Google, and Apple, as well as many that don't and fail. But I think more generally, the term Silicon Valley is similar to Wall Street or Hollywood in that it represents an industry of tech companies, and they could be anywhere in the world, but the beating heart of it happens to be, you know, in the actual Silicon Valley area.
From an outsider looking in, it seems as though this industry or this area is pretty much rife with fraud. Obviously, that's probably an over-exaggeration, but looking in, it seems like they're the big stories that we hear about in the UK sometimes. So how true is it that there is a lot of things going on that shouldn't be going on in Silicon Valley?
I think that's a fair assessment.
Right.
I think we do focus a lot on the scandals and the fraud because those are the juiciest stories. And there are plenty of companies, there are many, many companies that are not committing fraud or even getting close to it that are successful that maybe don't grab the headlines that Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX or Theranos grab. But I also think it's true that we have been seeing more of these headlines recently, and that's partly because the industry has gotten so much bigger. There's just so much more money that has been poured into startups and just the venture capital asset class over the last decade. It has increased more than eightfold since, you know, 2012 or so. And so when there's a lot of free money to be had, that's going to attract a lot of people who are maybe not the best actors and see a way to exploit that. And so those frauds or those bad actors are allowed to, are able to, you know, get a lot farther with it too before they get caught. And in tandem with that growth, we've seen the U.S. Department of Justice really step up their investigations and enforcements of white collar fraud. So, you know, I think I wrote in a story last week that the Department of Justice said that the last 2 years have been a record for white collar investigations for them. So I think, you know, as the tech industry grows and matures, it's starting to look more like a different industry that deals a lot in finance and money, and that's Wall Street. And so, you know, there's tons of white collar fraud happening on Wall Street all the time. And we're just starting to see kind of the equivalent of that in startup world too.
You said there that you wrote about this last week, but you've been writing about this kind of thing for quite a long time. I think I saw in 2016, you wrote for Fortune an article that was titled "The Ugly, Unethical Underside of Silicon Valley." We've mentioned SBF. What other examples are there? What other high-profile examples are there other than what we've seen recently from him?
So I'm glad you mentioned that story because that was all the way back in 2016. And I kept seeing these scandals happen in startups. It seemed to be a pattern. And this was even before the whole Uber thing blew up. It was right after Theranos. And a lot of the scandals that I wrote about in that article never turned out to be criminal. You know, no one from Uber really got charged with any kind of like criminal behavior out of some of that reporting. But it just seemed like there was just a lot of bad behavior. Like we were just learning about, you know, for the first half of the 2010s, I would say the narrative around tech startups was just around hope and excitement. Like, oh my God, look, they're like helping with revolutions in the Middle East and the Arab Spring. And these tech companies are going to, you know, everything they could do or everything they were doing seemed like it was a good thing. Mm. And suddenly we started to see, like, wait a minute, some of them are, you know, deceiving us, or some of them are overstating what they can do. And in the case of Theranos, they literally don't even have technology that works. And we were lauding these people. So it was just kind of like come to Jesus moment for, I think, a lot of people who had been cheering on the tech industry's development. Like, wait a minute, we need to take a step back and look at what is actually happening behind the scenes. And since then, I think that has actually evolved into what we've seen over the last couple of years, which is a lot of criminal fraud cases. You know, in addition to FTX, which everyone knows about, and Theranos, which is also very famous, there's been a lot of smaller ones that are lesser known too. Charlie Javis is the founder of a startup called Frank, which, you know, JP Morgan acquired the company for $175 million. And after they did, they found out that allegedly she had been fabricating accounts. And so the company had far fewer users than she said they had. And there's another company called Outcome Health that the founder was recently convicted on kind of a form of like insurance fraud or defrauding investors. There are a lot of smaller examples like this. I just wrote about one last week. The founder of Headspin, Manish Lachwani, is going to be going to jail for a year and a half for defrauding investors about the revenue and customer base of his company, Headspin. So we're seeing this kind of steady drumbeat of examples of founders who lied to investors or exaggerated what their tech could do or exaggerated to customers and are now facing really serious consequences.
Why is that? What is it about this world? I'm going to call it a world because it really does seem like a bubble. What is it about this world that allows for these characters to really emerge and thrive until they don't?
Well, I do think it is kind of baked into the DNA of Silicon Valley. And I think people who work in tech would not want to admit that, but I think they might be in a little bit of denial after watching so many of these play out and kind of studying how they were allowed to happen. And part of it is just that is the nature of innovation, is like you are creating as a tech founder a version of the future that you want to see exist. You're kind of making it up and trying to will it into existence. And a lot of times you might be wrong or you fail for various reasons. And that doesn't necessarily make you a fraud. Going all the way back to Steve Jobs or earlier, you know, companies often have this sort of hustle mentality where they do fake it till they make it. They might say, I mean, even Elon Musk has done this as well, announcing a product before it's remotely ready and then using that as a motivation for your employees and your team. Like, now we have to deliver this because we said we were going to. And, you know, if you are successful and you actually deliver it, then you're a winner and you're a hero. And if you don't, then, then you might have committed fraud. There are many stories like that that are part of the Silicon Valley lore. And, you know, investors sometimes encourage that. You know, you're trying to pull off the impossible. And the problem is, where is the line between fraud and a little bit of hype and a little bit of exaggeration to get people excited and to get people on board with your vision? And I think we're seeing that a lot more now in many of these cases. It's like if you like just straight up lie about your revenue or you know tell investors about certain technology that works that actually doesn't, like that's pretty clear cut fraud. And I think founders are learning that. But in the moment when you're crossing that line, it can maybe be a little bit blurrier from the inside when you're that founder who's under all this pressure and has raised all this money and made all these promises. It can maybe be a little harder to see where that line is.
Yeah, I think clearly some founders are just completely oblivious to where that line is, and also maybe don't actually want to recognize where that line is as well. But just on that phrase, fake it until you make it, because that is ludicrous. That is the biggest red flag if I've ever heard one. Just talk me through that phrase a little bit. Where has it come from? And does it reflect the industry correctly, do you think?
It's funny because I've lately been sitting in courtrooms a lot, you know, listening to judges and lawyers debate the actual phrase. Like last week, the judge was saying, you know, I know that fake it till you make it is a part of Silicon Valley, but I need to send a message to founders that, sure, they can fake it if they want to, but lying to investors about your revenue is a crime. And that came up in the Theranos case too. You know, yes. They specifically debated whether or not Elizabeth Holmes could use as part of her defense that this is just part of the Silicon Valley culture. And the judge said, sure, you can say that, but you know, the jury is going to evaluate her statements based on what investors could have reasonably taken away. And, you know, they obviously found that she had deceived investors. I think it's partly just like the nature of hype, particularly, you know, around consumer facing companies where you need to get people really excited about your product and the possibilities of it in order to get people to even try it, to download a new app or to sign up for a new account. And so you have to sell this mission of like, we're going to change the world and we're doing more than just like, you know, selling you a mattress over the internet. We are revolutionizing sleep. And so there's this sort of like whole almost mission-driven thing that comes along with some of these companies that seems a little bit silly when you pull back from it, but I think it's really easy to get kind of wrapped up in that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one thing that is also perhaps forgotten is there are real world impacts by the things that these founders have carried out. Theranos, for example, being a massive one, being a blood testing startup as well. And then SBF with the amount of money that was involved.
I think that's actually why those two cases in particular have gotten so much attention, is because of the real world impact. I mean, people were getting blood tests and making health decisions based on their test results. People were trusting FTX with their hard-earned money. And, you know, that's, I think, why cases like the one I covered last week with Headspin, where it's like, okay, these are just some venture capital investors who, you know, won't be as rich as they may have been because the valuation dropped from $1 billion to $300 million. It's like, that's less of a like real world impact. It's on the same spectrum as those companies, but it's not as directly impactful to people's everyday lives.
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned being in courtrooms and seeing these stories really unfold. I just want to get on to those stories, because I think you wrote that these startups almost have a community feeling amongst each other. And when these stories do get picked up, they tend to band together. Is that right? Is that still true?
Yeah, I mean, it is an ecosystem. And that's part of what makes the whole Silicon Valley magic tick, or to make it work, I should say, is like, you know, there's these venture capitalists, they invest in the companies, the founders, you know, need the talent and the tech workers to like actually make it work. And it all kind of feeds on itself and they kind of cross-pollinate. And that's what makes this like more of an ecosystem and an industry, not just a couple of discrete companies here or there. And they do kind of live in a little bit of a bubble and they do like view it's tribal sometimes, and there is this kind of knee-jerk defense where they feel like they're the underdogs. That's kind of a little bit of a startup mentality, because it's kind of like a renegade culture, like it's us against the, we're disrupting the status quo. And so as a part of that, they feel like they're always under attack and they're always like, you know, defending themselves and each other. And so there is a little bit of a reflexive, like us against them mentality. And when there's a negative story that comes out that's criticizing a founder, I think the venture capitalists who back them have a very knee-jerk reaction of like, no, we will defend them and we will stand by our portfolio companies. That has become interesting over the last few years as more of these frauds have been revealed. I mean, right after Theranos, the first Wall Street Journal article came out exposing some of the lies and deceptions that were happening at Theranos, like not even the whole picture, just a tiny sliver in that first story. There were VCs who tweeted and said, you know, I'm sure that they're building something great. And like, this is an unfair attack and this is a hit piece. And, you know, then those kind of went away as more and more of the problems at the company were revealed. But that is like, I think, a knee-jerk reaction. And the same kind of went for some of the stuff when there were negative stories about WeWork. And then when the IPO filing came out, I don't know if you remember this, but WeWork's IPO filing had a lot of really crazy stuff in it. And that's when some of the VCs were like, whoa, okay, maybe we're not going to defend this company as publicly anymore. But it's like kind of defend until you can't anymore mentality, which I think that's true in a way of any industry. You know, when the media is attacked, like there's a little bit of a knee-jerk like, oh, well, let's stick up for media. And then you dig in a little bit more and you're like, oh, maybe that was deserving or that of criticism, and maybe that wasn't. So yeah, there is a circle of the wagons mentality for sure.
How fair is it to attribute some of the blame to the emergence of some of these fraudulent characters? How fair is it to pin some of the blame on those venture capitalists and those investors, for example, who might not have investigated properly into where their funds are going to end up and who is dealing with their funds?
The question of diligence. I mean, these are the venture capital investors that are backing these startups are sophisticated. They have pitched, you know, the world's universities and sovereign wealth funds on their level of sophistication. Like, we can find the best founders. We are responsible stewards of your capital, and you'll pay us huge fees in order to do that. But there's also an element of FOMO, or fear of missing out, that happens in this industry, because there's only so many good startups that are going to become the next Facebook or Google. And there's lots of duds. And so when a startup or an area gets really hot, like how AI is right now, or crypto was 4 years ago, they all kind of rush in and are competing with one another. And so, you know, the best way to get into the hottest deals is to not ask too many questions and to, to, you know, offer the best terms and be the quote unquote founder friendliest, where you're going to, you know, let the founder perhaps not have a board, or you're not going to take a board seat, or you're going to say that we'll never vote against the founder in any kind of conflict on the board. And so the accountability really goes away for the hottest companies sometimes. And that leaves an area where, if you're kind of maybe not the most ethical founder, or if you're willing to cut corners to get ahead, you can really take advantage of that. And many companies, I should say, like many companies don't. Many companies are not being accused of fraud in the tech industry. But those who want to do that, you know, there are lots of opportunities because of the way that this ecosystem works.
Some people might think that investment is completely drying up, or would, when you see the amount of things that happen, things that go wrong. You'd think that people might become more cautious, but it seems as though, from what I've hearing from you, that investment isn't drying up at all, and it's just becoming a more lucrative industry. Is that true?
You would think, right? I mean, 2020, 2021 were some of the craziest years for investment in venture capital. I mean, there was no diligence being done.
Yeah.
People were just writing checks willy-nilly. It was a really frothy and hot time. And in the fallout of that, we've seen that a lot of these companies turned out to be full of crap. And some of them were committing fraud, and some of them just kind of failed.
Right.
And you would think, as part of the fallout of that, firms would be doing more diligence, you know, reassessing their investment strategies and how they're assessing their own investments. And maybe a little bit of that happened. But this AI boom is just the same thing all over again, where they're just, you know, rushing to get into the hottest companies. There's this element of FOMO. And I'm not sure that anything is changing, other than some of these crimes or frauds are actually being prosecuted in criminal court.
So what would change things? Or is it too hard to be able to see where anything could change, because all of these incidents are highly integral and hard to understand for a lot of people? But what could change? What realistically would make a difference?
Well, I do think that the headlines around FTX and Theranos and some of these other smaller ones, where founders are literally going to jail, does have some kind of deterrent factor.
Sure.
You know, if you saw, oh my God, they're giving away free money in Silicon Valley, I'm going to go out there and like, I don't care if I have a real company or whatever, if I screw these rich people out of some of their money, they're not going to prosecute me because they're too ashamed, which is true. A lot of times VCs don't go after, you know, frauds because it doesn't look good to be going after a founder, and they can kind of cover it up. And a lot of the failures are small enough that it won't get headlines anyway. So, like, you know, as I've said, the Department of Justice and the SEC are going after more of these now. So they're coming into the public eye. I do think there's a little bit of a deterrent there when you see, oh, I could actually go to jail. Yeah. I could get arrested. That's bad. And that hasn't been the case for a really long time. Most people who get caught deceiving investors or just stretching the truth or exaggerating a little bit, behaving unethically, have kind of gotten, you know, maybe a little bit of an industry downfall, like Adam Neumann or Travis Kalanick have you know, gotten fired, or but they've walked away with tons of money and they haven't faced like real serious consequences, and they've been allowed to come back and start new companies.
Yeah.
But when you look at clear-cut fraud cases like Theranos or FTX, these are people that are currently in prison. And so I think that will have a bit of a deterrent factor. And the judges in these cases talk about that extensively, where we do want to see people going to prison for committing securities fraud, because that is a deterrent to others. So I do think that, you know, people are going to be a lot more careful about what they put in their pitch decks. You know, if there's someone who kind of plays fast and loose with the numbers a little bit, maybe they'll have a lawyer look over it before they send it to investors. I don't think it's going to come from the investor side,
right?
But I think it might come from the founder side, just thinking twice about like, could this be securities fraud?
Yeah. Just to finish off, Erin, you wrote in the New York Times about this time last year that faking it is over. I was going to ask you whether Silicon Valley has largely finally learned its lesson, but it seems as though perhaps not. But just to flip it over to make it a little bit more positive to end on, is there anything positive to look for in the future with Silicon Valley? Is there a direction it can go towards that is positive?
I mean, I think in general, it's a boom and bust industry. There are moments of wild euphoria. And during those times, there's a lot of innovation that happens. And, you know, one or two companies might make it out and become like tent poles of our economy and, you know, make everyone's lives better in various ways and maybe a little bit worse in other ways too. And lots of other bad things will happen alongside. There's a lot of sort of collateral damage that happens from those bubbles. And that includes people committing fraud. That includes companies failing, you know, people losing money, not because of fraud, but just because it was a bad idea that shouldn't have been funded. But people who take a sort of positive view of this boom and bust mentality say that like it's always going up. It's always, even though there's ups and downs, like the downs are slightly higher than the last time and the ups are slightly higher. And so in general, there's like forward progress happening. That's the most positive take that I think you could take on this, you know. And so part of that fallout is that there will be some people who kind of take advantage of that. And maybe that's just part of the circle of life.
I'm sure you're looking forward to covering even more fraud cases in the future then. Erin, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
If you're listening and you like what we do, why not help us to bring you more? From just £3 a month, you'll get our episodes first, ad-free, and access to our exclusive merchandise. I'm Chris Jones, reporting from The Bunker.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election, and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof, or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann-Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written, presented, and produced by Chris Jones. The audio producer was me, Jade Bailey. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.